Is some of the violence seen during recent demonstrations a legitimate means of protest? What do the different religions have to say about the use of violence in search of a greater good? Join me, Martin Bashir, alongside three of America's most prominent faith leaders on Heart and Soul. Hello, I'm Martin Bashir, and welcome to this special edition of Heart and Soul from the BBC World Service. The arc of the moral universe is long, said Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but it bends toward justice. Those words contained an optimism and confidence that justice would ultimately triumph, that equal rights for all people under God would come to pass. But try telling that to African American communities across the United States today.
I'm 45 years old.
45 and I'm 31.
And I'm tired of seeing
the older generation than me, and I am too.
And we've been standing around as the older ones, taking all this bull, always hoping for a kumbaya.
Come here.
Always standing around for a kumbaya. Ain't nobody coming to protect us.
In the days after George Floyd was killed, people took to the streets, and their anger at another death at the hands of police spilled over into violence. The words in that clip, caught on a smartphone, encapsulates an argument that's been raging for decades, even centuries. Can America be reconciled with non-violent activism, or does history prove that peaceful protest simply doesn't deliver justice in the long term? Joining me now for what I'm sure will be a conversation full of light and some heat is Ilyasa Shabazz, an author and social activist and the third daughter of Malcolm X and Betty Shabazz. Joshua Dubois served in the White House Office of Faith-Based Partnerships under President Barack Obama. And Lama Rod Owens is an author, activist and credentialed Buddhist teacher. Thank you for joining me. And if I might begin with Ilyasa, the death of George Floyd not only set off protests in all 50 states, but around the world. Have you been surprised by the intensity and breadth of these protests?
You know, I'm not surprised. I have to say that I'm happy. I'm happy that we are understanding the oneness of man. One of the things that you mentioned in your opening is a moral universe that Dr. King mentioned. And so I'm going to assume that this generation, they are morally conscientious, and I'm relieved that we have united in 50 states, 18 countries, to fight against this kind of corruption and terror against its own citizens.
Joshua, a moral nation, one nation under God, we're told. Is that what you see in America today?
We are certainly a nation united on some points, but divided on many points. And listen, that is because of our national story. In 1619, of course, the first human beings were brought to this country from Africa, not as human beings, but treated as chattel, as animals, as slaves. That continued for literally centuries. So this is not surprising. It's not surprising that we are still divided on these points because we have not yet fully unpacked or resolved our national story.
Lama, given your own religious background, one in which the goal of Buddhism is not just internal but global peace, what is your view of the protests that have become violent?
Well, you know, I think that for me, we have to do work to get free. We have to do work to get socially free. We have to do the work to get ultimately free. You know, freedom takes work, it takes effort, it takes diligence, you know, and that for me and my practice in Buddhism begins with the inner work. I have to start looking at my own trauma. I have to start looking at my own anger and rage and hurt, you know, and then I want to link that work to the work of the collective to really begin to understand what justice looks like, you know, and that opens the door even further to this experience of the ultimate, of touching into the divine. You know, there's no divine experience without first understanding how to live collectively in a just and ethical world on the ground with others.
Ilyasa, your father once accused Dr. King of enabling whites to continue their attacks on people of color. Let's hear him in his own words.
The white man pays Reverend Martin Luther King, subsidizes Reverend Martin Luther King, so that Reverend Martin Luther King can continue to teach the Negroes to be defenseless. That's what you mean by nonviolent. Be defenseless. Be defenseless in the face of one of the most cruel beasts that has ever taken the people into captivity. That's just the American white man. And they have proved it throughout the country by the police dogs and the police clubs. 100 years ago, they used to put on a white sheet and use a bloodhound against Negroes. Today, they have taken off the white sheet and put on police uniforms. They've traded in the bloodhounds for police dogs, and they're still doing the same thing. And just as Uncle Tom, back during slavery, used to keep the Negroes from resisting the bloodhound or resisting the Ku Klux Klan by teaching them to love their enemy or pray for those who use them despitefully. Today, Martin Luther King is just a 20th century or modern Uncle Tom or a religious Uncle Tom who is doing the same thing today to keep Negroes defenseless in the face of attack.
Ilyasa, does history prove that your father was right?
Well, first I want to say that it is important to put it in context because my father often spoke about self-defense, and it's much like if someone throws a bomb into your home and your house catches a fire, you don't sit in the house and let the fire consume you. You immediately go to get your family out of the home for protection, and then you go to put the fire out. And so these are some of the things that my father said was extremely important, that, you know, again, if you're looking at a moral compass and those who are oppressing and terrorizing you don't have that, then you have to find another method to end these injustices.
Joshua, your former boss, President Obama, supported Dr. King's unprincipled nonviolent approach. And of course, Dr. King's principle was based on the biblical principle of turning the other cheek, of loving your enemies. But it doesn't seem to have been very effective, does it?
Well, I'd question a couple parts of that, although I think it's an important question. One, I think Dr. King was extraordinarily effective. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and many other sort of fundamental changes.
Dr. King, we just heard, Malcolm X say, in that day, they used dogs. Today, we have tear gas and military equipment.
Absolutely. So I think the underlying conditions that African Americans face, some things have changed and many and far too many have not. But I do want to question a fundamental frame of this conversation, and that is about sort of the outbreak of violence in the United States. I think that serves, you know, a framework and sort of a message that we're hearing from people like President Trump and others, when in fact, violence is a really small part of what's happening in the country. There's an outbreak of awareness. There's an outbreak of activism. There's an outbreak of companies and brands for the first time acknowledging the value of Black life. There's an outbreak of planning for the next phase of the civil rights movement. And yes, there is a small part of the country, of the population, that where there is some violence, but there's something much bigger than violence happening here. The last thing I'll say on that is we have to ask ourselves the question, which one of these is our framework? Do we say it's a shame about George Floyd, but the rioting and violence has to stop? Or it's a shame about the property damage, but the killing of Black men has to stop? And if we're more focused on the violence, the relatively small amounts of violence and rioting, than we are on the fundamental change that needs to happen in this country and that is finally being discussed, then I think that's a fundamental problem.
I think you're right to frame the issue in its limited terms, and that's true. Not every protest has turned violent. Indeed, the majority have been entirely peaceful. But nevertheless, I come back to you, Joshua.
Yeah.
Is it the basic principle of the Christian to turn the other cheek and accept this? I mean, are we supposed to say to Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, Walter Scott, Alter Sterling, Philando Castile, Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, just some of those who have died at the hands of law enforcement in the United States. Are we supposed to say to those protesting that the Christian way is the way to achieve change?
Well, I think we need to understand what the Christian way actually is, because there's two things that Jesus did that I'd like to point out to. One, he talked about turning the other cheek. The other thing he did was that he entered into the temple and physically turned over the tables of the money changers and those who were exploiting people of his day. And so that was a confrontational, still civil but active act of opposition. And that is what we're seeing in American streets today. And so the Christian method message is, yes, when it comes to an individual, seek to operate with as much love and charity and turning the other cheek as you can. But when it comes to systemic oppression, when it comes to things that are exploiting people, confront that head on. And by the way, that's Dr. King's message too, and Malcolm X's. And Ilyas will know this much more than I, but they're much less far apart than a lot of people think. Dr. King, the famous quote is, the riots are a language of the unheard. Go back a couple of sentences in his speech at Stanford University. He says, I think Americans must see that riots do not develop out of thin air. Certain conditions continue to exist in our society, which must be condemned as vigorously as we condemn riots. Malcolm X said the same in a speech at the London School of Economics in 1965. I love the quote. He said, but whoever heard of a sociological explosion that was done intelligently and politely? He was basically saying that that of course we can't manage the way people respond to the injustice in front of them. But the point is to focus on the injustice.
Indeed. Lama, of course, Thomas Hobbes, who was the 17th century English philosopher, described violence as a rational means to achieve political goals such as territory, safety and glory. But when you speak to young people yourself, do you find that you're speaking, when you speak in terms of your own Buddhist faith, you're speaking a foreign language in a way?
No, I believe that when I'm speaking with young people, and really anyone, I'm coming from my direct experience of what it means to occupy a Black body. I come from the Black radical tradition. I came into Buddhism because it offered a means for me to look really deeply and intensely into my experience and to really try to figure out how I could actually experience love and compassion and still be embodied and still do the work of getting both socially and spiritually free. And so I find that young people really connect to that.
Ilyas, your father was a proud member of the Nation of Islam. Did he find justification for his style of protest from his Muslim faith?
Oh, goodness. My father gave 199% because of his faith in God. And, one of the things that we learned in our household was, the truth in education. I think our educational curriculum has a lot to do with this. We need, in the United States, an improved, and really around the world, an improved educational curriculum for our next generation that's based on facts, so that they understand that American history includes Black history, that world history includes the history of the diaspora, it includes the history of Africa. If the massacres in Tulsa and Rosewood were already shown in U.S. history classes, for example, to be as American as the Boston Tea Party, more citizens would understand the need for reparations. These kinds of examples that my father continually pushed and continually highlighted.
Joshua, Malcolm X also highlighted the fact that Christians had enjoyed the benefits of slavery. And of course, in the 17th century, the Society for the Promotion of Christian Knowledge had its own slaves branded with a red-hot iron in Barbados with the word society. So do you understand why Malcolm X not only rejected Dr. King's political non-violent activism, and we've just heard him say that, but he also had a problem with Dr. King's theology?
Yes, I think that throughout history, people have exploited Christianity as well as other faiths, for their own ends. And too often those ends have been the subjugation of marginalized people. We've literally seen that across every different faith tradition. You can find a major story, a major theme, a major moment in history where that faith was exploited to subjugate people. What we have to be able to do is make a distinction between the faith and the way that men and sometimes women, but more often men, unfortunately, misuse that faith. Slavery occurred in the United States because of greed and because of white supremacy, and Christianity was misused and abused to advance slavery. I think that's more about the tendency and the flaws of men than it is about the underlying thing.
But Lama, we know for a fact that President Trump won over 80% of white evangelicals and 70% of white Catholics. When Joshua was talking about the last century, I'm giving you an example of the current presidency.
Mm-hmm. And it continued. You know, that's still the work that we're marching against. This is still the work we're organizing against. We're trying to actually unroot the expression of white supremacy, capitalism, patriarchy within our expression of religion and practice and religiosity, you know, and that work has to continue, you know, by any means necessary.
How do you reconcile any means, if that includes violence, with your Buddhism?
Well, you know, Martin, the thing that Buddhism has given me, you know, and my practice in Buddhism has given me is wisdom, is clarity. And that wisdom actually helps me to understand what to do in the moment. You know, what's the most skillful thing to do in the moment, right? And so in a moment, I have to look at everything that's going on. You know, sometimes there are things at stake that require action, that require aggression. In order to neutralize or in order for other forms of violence to be disrupted. So in a moment, if I see something happening and I know the only way for me to actually disrupt that situation is by actually getting physically involved, then I will make that choice. You know, and this is very much in the same way when a parent sees their child being hurt. Like a parent instantly acts to protect their child. And this is the kind of motivation that we can generate in our practice.
But how do you reconcile that? You're talking about taking physical action against people. How does that work when you believe a theology that principally works on the basis of complete submission, non-violence?
The thing about the understanding of peace in Buddhism is that it's oversimplified by folks outside of the practice. Peace is not the absence of conflict. Actually, peace is how we hold the space for conflict to arise, you know? And so when conflict arises, then the space that I cultivate through a practice of peace actually gives me, you know, the tools to respond to that conflict in a way that's skillful. You know, and nonviolence isn't always the most skillful thing to do.
So you would say that in certain circumstances, the need to act in a physically belligerent manner actually is a greater priority than maintaining a peaceful coexistence without any kind of violence.
Well, I wouldn't use the word belligerent because I think when we have awareness around why we're acting, it actually becomes skillful. You know, so it may look belligerent, but it actually is a skillfulness and awareness to how we're actually moving into action to disrupt something. And it doesn't always have to be violent and disruptive, you know, but it has to be that in the moment because we haven't created a sustainable movement over decades.
Indeed. Dr. King himself, of course, was asked a similar question about whether he was leading a group of people who were doing very little because they were nonviolent. Let's hear what his response was.
We are not engaged in a struggle that means we sit down and do nothing. That there's a great deal of difference between non-resistance to evil and nonviolent resistance. Non-resistance leaves you in a state of stagnant passivity and deadened complacency. wherein nonviolent resistance means that you do resist in a very strong and determined manner.
Joshua, do you accept the critique that peaceful political activism is always welcomed by governments and people in power because it's easier to subdue and ultimately ignore? Of course, the state prefers pacifism. The alternative is much more disturbing, isn't it?
It really supports something Ilya said, so wisely said earlier. You know, without this tension, without the confrontation, without the type of context, for example, that her father created in the late 50s and early 60s, we might not have had the progress that we saw then with the 64 and 65 laws, and we might not be seeing the progress that we're experiencing now, like those statues coming down, without the tensions in the streets. And so it is absolutely appropriate that they're coming down, but they would not be coming down if activists in the streets had not forced this tension in the same way that Malcolm X forced the tension in his day to create the context for change.
Ilyasa, Joshua was just referring to the fact of the Civil Rights and the Voting Rights Acts, which are incredible achievements, 1964 and 65. But isn't it also true that one of the most significant features of racial justice in America is what we might describe as backlash and backwards movements, two steps forward, one step back?
That's right. That's right. Every time we make some progress, you know, we become complacent, and then we're undermined. Much like after the Civil Rights Movement, we made great strides. However, there were many people who were either assassinated, became political prisoners. You know, it's an unfortunate game that those who are in power continue to use, and a rather unfortunate one. And so it's why I'm hoping that this generation, in their protesting, that they will make sure that they have measured goals and that they do not stop until they accomplish each one of those goals.
As we draw our discussion towards a conclusion, there are several goals that have been proposed during recent protests: addressing inherent racism within the criminal justice system, the question raised so eloquently by the writer Ta-Nehisi Coates of reparations, defunding and restructuring police departments, in addition to addressing all of the discriminatory practices that define so many employers in America. If I could ask each of you, and if I could begin with Lama, can you prioritise the goals that you have as this protest movement in 2020, albeit in a pandemic America, as it moves through? What are your goals?
Yeah, you know, and I'll just say, like, statues coming down, major organizations and institutions releasing Black Lives Matter statements doesn't make America less racist. You know, and I think those kinds of things in the past have distracted us from the real work. You know, and for me, in terms of your question, for me, the real work, the real goals are for me to begin to see white people in this country en masse coming out and rejecting white supremacy, you know, disrupting the foundations of white supremacy, the ways in which they've been conditioned into white supremacy, and to begin to do this really deep repair work, you know, to let go of power, to challenge privilege, you know, to be in real allyship with Black and brown communities. So those are my goals.
Ilyasa, the Reverend Al Sharpton, who gave the eulogy at George Floyd's memorial service, said Black people had been struggling because a knee had been pressing down on their collective necks for decades. So tell us, how does America take its knee off the necks of African Americans?
Well, from my father, we need action. And to affect societal change at any level, pressure must be applied from all levels. And so we need solutions-oriented, determined, and visionary Black leaders in the state houses, halls of Congress, in the courts of law, in local communities. The struggle for justice should not be a lifetime pursuit, and yet it remains one. So all activists and leaders must remain vigilant and unafraid when the backlash comes, and never cow to those who confuse human life, the value of one's life, with the value of a storefront window.
Joshua, is it possible that nonviolent and violent protests have actually combined in 2020 and may yet produce an outcome of equality and justice?
Well, what I would say is that I think more peaceful and conciliatory protests have combined with more active, progressive, discordant protests, many of which have not been violent, and there has been some violence as well, to create a context where things are beginning to change. That does not justify harming another individual, whether by hand or bullet or, you know, Molotov cocktail. But what it does say is that there has to be a climate for change, and it also says that change has been a long time coming, and people are fed up. And so now issues, ideas, histories are on the table in a way that they haven't been before, not just in the United States, but around the globe. You know, in the UK, obviously, major protests, but also not just in these specific black-white contexts in the US. You know, the uprising in Ethiopia right now with the Oromo people fighting for their rights and more. This is a time where people who have been marginalized are saying enough is enough, and now is the time to make historical wrongs right. And that's a very exciting thing.
Joshua Dubois, Ilyasa Shabazz, and Lama Rod Owens, thank you so much for joining us. And this has been Heart and Soul, presented by Martin Bashir and produced by Rajiv Gupta.